Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. After the first segment today, you will hear my co-host, Alfred Addisk, and James Corbett of the Corbett Report. They will finish out the program, as they do on Thursdays, for October 8th, 2015. Once again, thank you for joining us this afternoon. And a lot of things are going on. Let's check to see what the market is doing today in gold and silver. You have gold down 490 at 1141. Silver down 38 at $15.78. I got a nice, an interesting report, a short one. We're going to talk about silver, about the United States and India. And, but let me finish the report, the markets first. Platinum was up $5 today at $955. Palladium was also up $3 at $704. The USDX today was down slightly, 0.28 at $95.31. Crude oil had another big day, up 1.85 at $49.66. And I guess all worries are gone about China, and you know, everything is good in the world again. Who cares about debt? Cares about stimulus? You know, everything's great in this make-believe world we live in. The Dow was up 138 points today, but it did break over that 17,000 level, 17,050. The NASDAQ was up 19 at 4810. The S&P was up 17 at 2013. The 10-year yield popped big, 0.05 at 211%. Euro was also up 0.32 and 1.13 at 1.13. Foreign markets, not a lot of action there. Pretty much, you know, we weren't up, the Dow wasn't up 1%, and that's pretty much what we've seen in London and Germany and Asian markets. So not a lot of actions worldwide, not like what we saw today in hours. So a little bit of pressure on the precious metals. But as I mentioned, the U.S. was overtaken by India as the world's largest importer of silver. You know, both these nations, both the U.S. and India, they absorb about 63% of the forecasted mine supply of silver for 2015. But now you have India is the largest importer of silver. And India is forecasted to be responsible for importing 340 million ounces. The U.S. is going to absorb about 193 million ounces. And we see the change in 2007. India had imported 80 million. In the United States, we imported 153 million. And so we certainly see India getting stronger and the U.S. getting weaker. And, of course, I say weaker for the United States. It's because, you know, silver is used as an industrial metal. So the U.S. does not have the need. Since our industry base has declined, we don't have the same need as India for that silver. So, therefore, you have India overtaking the United States in the imports of silver, and mainly due to India's large industrial base has continued to grow as the United States industrial designs or industrial demand has declined. Today, the big news is all mainstream media. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, he was considered the front runner to replace Boehner, and he withdrew from the race. And what's interesting is he did this just a few moments before they were ready to nominate most likely him as the Republicans' candidate to replace Boehner. And McCarthy gave no indication of dropping out earlier in the day. In fact, he said it's going to be great. He said Thursday morning. And so someone didn't want him in there. And most importantly, gee, what did he do? He must have one heck of a skeleton in his closet. And so something is coming in up that, number one, either they want a Boehner to stay in there long enough to get done whatever needs to be done, that they they need someone to replace Boehner that's on their side, not quite like McCarthy. So he must. I just figure whether he's having some sort of an affair that's been brought out, his association with these Benghazi investigations, you know, maybe it had something to do with that. Everything sort of remains to be seen exactly. But Boehner, he was set to resign at the end of the month, but he said in his statement today that he's going to serve as Speaker until the House votes to elect a new one. You know, and, you know, of course, he says that he's sure there will be a new one in the coming weeks. However, how long is Boehner going to stay? You know, so if they don't have one by the end of October 30th, you know, heck, we could see Boehner there for a long time. I mean, it seems like the Republican, the GOP is just sort of falling apart. They can't do anything right altogether. Today, Fed's minutes from the September meeting came out today, and gee, I guess they were a little concerned maybe about a contagion from China. They said they are worried about the economic slowdown in China. And and its potential to keep the U.S. inflation persistently low. Minutes of the September 16th, 17th minutes or meeting discussion showed the central bank believed the time for the first Fed rate increase in 9 years might be near, blah, blah, blah. That's what they keep saying. But I've got a report. We're going to talk about the IMF, and it actually came out yesterday. I hope we had touched on it yesterday, but we didn't have the opportunity to, so I will today. And so it does show that that the U.S. is concerned about China's slowdown. There is a contagion, of course, and but they got a little bit of a reprieve. China seems to be turning around a little bit as far as their stock market is concerned. And that's all that matters to any of these people is the stock markets. Countries don't have economies anymore. They have a stock market. That's where people get their money. So the day of reckoning, you hear me talk about it all the time. The day of reckoning is just around the corner. We don't know when that day is. There could be an unplanned event, some sort of a hiccup in any of the markets, and which would start the beginning to finally the end until this illusion is busted. And but the IMF has a new report that says $3 trillion of corporate credit crunch looms as debtors face day of reckoning. And this report talks about the global risks, how it's pushing the world to the brink of a new financial crisis. And this is what the IMF report talks about. It talks about how the governments and central banks risk tipping the world into this new financial crisis and the corporate debt binge in the developing world. And, you know, we've talked about this before, you know, the amount of margin debt, money being borrowed, leveraged, the margin levels never been as high as before. To the levels they are today, and it's all on all these markets. There's so much leverage and so much debt. These corporations are borrowing money in order to fund their dividends, in order to buy back their shares. The corporate they've gone on this huge binge, and it's just not the emerging markets anymore that the IMF is concerned about. It's the U.S., it's Europe, it's Japan. I mean, Japan is slapping in, you know, trillions of their yens into stimulus, and what has it done for them? It's pushed their stock market up a little bit. They still can't get a hold of their economy. It's not working, which we could have told them that. It's not going to work. It hasn't worked here. It does help create the illusion that it's working. It keeps it actually falling into the abyss, but doesn't solve anything. It just keeps everything going for a little bit longer. This dangerous over-leveraging threatens to unleash a wave of defaults that will imperil an already weak global economy. And the IMF produces this report twice a year. The fund warned there was no margin for error for policymakers navigating these hazardous risks. The slightest miscalculation could collapse. And the failed normalization of interest rates and market conditions, wiping 3% from the world's economic output over the next 2 years. Well, I'm sorry to tell you, it's going to be more than 3% from the world's economic output over the next 2 years. Today, Deutsche Bank comes out and they start talking about a $7 billion loss in the third quarter. So you have all of these. So we're beginning to see these bigger and bigger losses coming from these banks. Even the Deutsche Bank, was it a week ago, 2 weeks ago? They talked about the perils of economies and the debt of countries and nations around the world, how we're just moments away from a collapse. This was from Deutsche Bank a week ago. We've been trying to get to this report for the last week, but we keep getting sidetracked, Alfred and myself. So we'll try to bring that again tomorrow. But and this Germany's biggest bank reported this on an unscheduled statement late Wednesday. And, you know, we know all that they're involved in as far as the manipulations of gold and silver they pulled out of, you know, so, you know, they have a history anyway. So we're going to go back to the IMF report. The world's major central banks should ensure policy remains accommodative for fear of setting off a new wave of instability that would see bond prices rise and asset prices collapse. Okay. Which means no rate increases for anyone. They can't increase the rates. You know, if they increase the rates, they're going to have more stimulus. They need to keep this going or it all collapses. It all fails. You're going to see, and we talk about with Greg Hunter, we talk about the collateral. You know, we talk about a disorderly selling, fire sales, redemptions, which creates more volatility. And in fact, Greg Hunter will be on our program Monday. He's scheduled to be on Monday. So make sure you tune in and write on your calendars that Greg Hunter from the USA Watchdog will be joining us on October 12th which I believe is Monday. So this report also called on the Federal Reserve, as I mentioned, to hold off on its first interest rate hike in 9 years. And for the authorities in the Eurozone and Japan to continue with unprecedented stimulus measures. How can anyone look at this report and feel confident that things are together and things are flowing as they should? I mean, the world economy exists because of the low rates in the U.S. and the trillions of stimulus, as I mentioned, by Japan and Europe. I mean, this should scare the pants off of anyone who even cares to understand just a small fraction of how huge this is. And that, how can anyone deny the importance of gold and silver when the IMF warns these nations about changing any current policies? I mean, we know the IMF came in earlier in the year to tell Janet Yellen, hey, you got to hold off. You know, maybe 2016, maybe longer. They told China, hey, you can't come into our SDRs until next year, too. I mean, there can't be any major changes in anything or the whole worldwide system collapses. You know, managing any outbreaks in financial contagion is going to require a huge funds being produced, money printing, to avoid and to stop the bleeding like we saw in 2008. And this will be nothing compared to 2008. The IMF painted a picture of a brittle financial system that was coming to the end of a period of cheap liquidity propped up by low rates. And we certainly saw some volatility in the summer stock market. Record capital flows from emerging markets. I mean, we haven't experienced anything yet. You think the summer market was volatile? That was laughable. That was nothing. That was child's play, what we saw as far as volatility in the markets. This is a challenge. The challenge will be abnormal market conditions to adjust smoothly to the new environment. The world is going to change. There will be a new environment. And people will have to adjust. And it isn't the central banks. It isn't the, you know, certainly you're going to see, you know, central banks. Certainly you're going to see everyone hurt. But where people around the world will be the ones who have to adjust to a new environment. Those who have saved, those who have planned, those who have sacrificed to provide for themselves, their children, their grandchildren, their retirement, these are the people that will lose the most. Unless, and they do have a choice. They can make a decision to protect what they have. And yeah, you know where I'm going with this. You need to be diversified into gold and silver. You have China's authorities. The IMF continues. China's authorities will also have to put up with corporate bankruptcies, debt defaults. So we're just not talking about the U.S., in the wake of a stock market collapse earlier this year, the report called on Beijing to embark on an orderly deleveraging by removing stabilizers, artificially propping up its indebted companies. And the last statement from the IMF, what we want to achieve is a successful normalization of financial conditions and monetary policies together with a sustained economic recovery. 3% of global output is at stake. So they know it's coming. They know what's going to happen, and they're trying to achieve a successful purging of the system. Well, that's not going to happen. So get prepared, folks. 1-800-375-4188. 3.88. And I think the IMF better hope it's only 3% of global output that is at stake, because personally, I believe it's going to be a lot more than that. Remember, folks, we got that special going on with the $5 AU Liberty gold piece. It's in an almost uncirculated condition. It's almost a quarter of an ounce. And 20 American Silver Eagles, dated 2015. These are 2015s. And the price on that special was $795. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. I hope you enjoyed the program with Alfred and James Corbett of the Corbett Report.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks, I'm Alfred Addis, and this is the American Independence Hour. I'm here with our guest, James Corbett, from thecorbettreport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T, corbettreport.com. James is speaking to us from Japan. He's been on the program almost once a week for a year now. Once in a while, we can't make the connection, but regardless, James is here, and certainly one of the most intelligent people around, articulate people around, and knowledgeable people around. Hello, James. How are you doing? That means someone James is supposed to be here. I am not supposed to be talking to myself. I do that in my
Hey, friend. I'm here.
All right. What happened? You button on
After that beautiful Sterling intro, I pressed the wrong button and hung up. So I'm not living up to my Sterling reputation today.
I guess I didn't say anything about being a master of pushing buttons. I said very intelligent guy.
Well, you'll notice I'm a bit under the weather today anyway, so I'm not going to be at 100%, I'm afraid.
Good. And in your weakened condition, maybe I'll be able to pose some intriguing questions.
I hope so.
Let's start out with some that aren't all that intriguing, but there's an article from CNN Money. And the headline is, Japan's Abenomics Experiment is on the rocks. And Prime Minister Abe in Japan has tried a Japanese form of quantitative easing to try to get the Japanese economy out of stagnation. It has not apparently worked, at least not yet. And is it true that Abenomics has failed in Japan? Is that an accurate statement right now, or is it a threat? And if so, what's next for Japan? And what's next for the global economy?
Well, it's absolutely the case that Abenomics has been a complete, utter failure. And there's a lot of different windows into that statistic. I think the one that's perhaps most pertinent is the declining real wages in Japan, which have been declining for most of the past 2 years on pretty much a straight down path. There's been a couple of months where it's raised its head above water, but for the most part, real wages in Japan have declined almost every single month for the past 2 years. I mean, that's a pretty blatant sign that whatever this is supposed to be doing in terms of stimulating economic activity, it is failing to reach the people who actually need it, the people at the bottom of the economic ladder here in Japan. Basically, the whole idea of this has been to do a massive monetary stimulus, basically a QE-style monetary stimulus, with the intent of doubling the money supply in the space of 2 years, couple that with increased government spending and supposed economic reforms and reforms of the corporate sector here in Japan, which is famously quite rigid and stuck in its ways. So there's been moves towards trying to at least give lip service to getting women more involved in the economy and things like that. And some of the windows into how that has been a spectacular failure. One of the government programs, there was a government program put in place for corporations to receive benefits if they put more women into executive positions. Not a single corporation actually applied for that benefit. So I think whatever they were attempting to do has obviously not worked. And that's reflected in the fact that now the GDP is shrank to 1.2% growth in the second quarter, and most economists are expecting when the Q3 results will come out that Japan will be technically back into recession. So it has absolutely failed on every front. And I think this is not only a reflection of what's going on in the world economy generally, I think it's also an indicator of what's I think it feeds back both ways. I think the world economic slowdown is part of what's causing this slowdown in Japan. But also, I think the slowdown in Japan and the fact that this is failing is going to feed back negatively on Japan's trading partners. And of course, Japan is still a heavily export dependent economy. So there's a lot of nations that are taking advantage of the weak yen, but there's not a lot of money coming back, and that's going to lead to a decline in Japanese consumer spending and slowdown in Japanese imports.
All right. We're going to see people in this country are going to have second thoughts about quantitative easing insofar as we see more evidence of quantitative easing failing in Japan. Does that give us any reason to hope that quantitative easing will work in this country?
Well, I mean, I think we've already seen the Federal Reserve has at least laid off of the gas pedal when it comes to the quantitative easing with their stimulus. So we're now at that strange, I guess the gear is in neutral at the moment, and everyone's waiting for this supposed rate hike, which is looking less and less likely to ever come, especially given the dismal September jobs reports that just came out in the U.S. and just absolutely well below everyone's expectations, so, which is another reason why the Fed is going to come out probably in the next month or two and say, well, you know, we just can't raise rates this year, and then it'll kick that ball down the road a little bit more. So I think everyone understands that the Fed has painted itself into the corner with its QE, and now that a lot of the world is involved in what is now being dubbed quantitative tightening, the kind of unwinding, the reversal of this QE, where we had that liquidity flooding out into the emerging markets. We had capital flowing out there from the U.S. dollar as the kind of borrowing currency, and then flooding out into the markets in the emerging economies. Now that's unwinding, and we see a lot of that trade coming back. And I think for the first time since 1989, I want to say, something along those lines, we've seen actual net import of capital from the emerging market economies rather than capital going out towards them. So I think we're starting to see the great unwind of everything. And the only button, really, the only lever that the Fed has left to do is more stimulus, more of the hair of the dog that bit them. So I think that's the only thing that they've got at this point.
I saw an article by Simon Black, Sovereign Man. You've probably seen some of his work. I saw an article a week or 10 days ago where he calculates that the Federal Reserve has about 1.3% more assets, primarily in the form of U.S. Treasuries, than it has liabilities, which he says translates into essentially a 1.3% net worth for the Federal Reserve. I'd look at it as a margin for error. It was an interesting article. That was the point to it. He didn't come to any final conclusions, any additional conclusions, but what crossed my mind is this. If the Federal Reserve has only 1.3% more bonds, primarily assets, than it has liabilities, and if it's true that the universal law of bonds is that when interest rates go up, the value of the bonds goes down, or when interest rates go down, the value of the bonds goes up, there's an inverse relationship between interest rates and the price of the bonds, then can the Federal Reserve dare to raise interest rates above 0.25%? Will raising interest rates cause the value of the bonds in the Fed's own vault, their own treasury? Will it cause them to fall by more than 1.3%? And if they do, does that render the Fed technically insolvent and arguably bankrupt? Are they really resisting the idea of raising bonds because the economy is too weak or because the Fed's balance sheet is too weak?
Right, raising rates. Yeah. I think it's, obviously both situations play into each other, and obviously the Fed is, if one were to look at it rationally and just look at the balance sheet as if this was a rational investment decision, then clearly the Fed is not in particularly on stable ground and would not be a good investment for someone if they were thinking of, you know, where to put their money. Of course, people can't put their money in the Federal Reserve in that sense, but it does give an indication of the overall financial stability of the heart, the backbone of the American banking system. And I think Simon Black also extends that analysis out to a lot of other individual banks in the Federal Reserve system, and shows that their balance sheets are similarly not up to par, that there's a lot
and
of
if interest rates go up, if they've put all of their Federal Reserve notes into one basket, that basket being U.S. Treasuries, if they raise interest rates, the face value of those treasuries go down, which means the value of their assets in their vaults and their individual treasury accounts, whatever, those go down, and now all of a sudden are the banks threatened with insolvency and perhaps bankruptcy.
Well, I think another aspect of this problem, this dilemma, is that the U.S. Treasury markets are already, there's extremely low liquidity in them because there's not a lot of buyers at the moment. Yeah. And so we saw that Treasury flash crash several months ago that in the space of a day, it brought prices. The U.S. Treasury market basically ground to a halt, and there was emergency operations to get it going again. And I think we could see, obviously, more of that if there is some sort of volatility in the markets. And what's the biggest volatility that could come is a rate hike of some sort. So.
Yeah.
Again, I think even people who are trying to divest of treasuries are probably going to have a hard time doing so if and when that rate starts rising, because the only buyer, I think, at that point is going to be the Federal Reserve. And,
I guess they
can continue. Well, they can
They're
continue.
Already painted into such a deep corner. I don't know if they can purchase more of those bonds.
There's no theoretical limit on their balance sheet. There's no point at which they can't print more money. They can continue to do that. The only question is when people stop buying into the system and stop believing in the Federal Reserve. When there's a bank run on the Federal Reserve, I mean, it wouldn't be a bank run like, you know, lining up at your bank to get money. Well, actually, that could precipitate it. But when there's that type of crisis for the Federal Reserve, that's the point at which that balance sheet becomes misleading. But ultimately, at this point, I mean, it doesn't matter if they have 1.3% margin or a 10% margin or a negative 50% margin. Everyone's still playing the game. Everyone's still, you know, playing the treasuries and the equities as if nothing's going wrong. So unfortunately, they can continue to perpetrate the fraud as long as people continue to go along with it.
But do you think people would continue to play along with the fraud once it became overtly clear, undeniable, that the Fed's liabilities were greater than its assets? Once that 1.3% disappears, is that mark the end? Is that the wake-up moment where people say, wait a second, you mean these people are insolvent?
Yeah. I would love to think
it's time to run. It's not just time to figure out. It's time to beat.
Yeah. I mean, there may be an appreciative difference, a qualitative difference in the reporting when it actually hits that moment of insolvency, technical insolvency. I mean, that could be a moment that would spark some headlines that would certainly at least get the Fed having to backpedal and explain itself. But given the fact that they've survived this long with such a large fraud, really since its inception, I mean, we're talking about a 101-year-long con that's been going on here, longer if you extend it back to when the Federal Reserve was first being planned in secret. I don't know. It almost seems at this point that there's no end to what the public will not believe and buy, if as long as it's sold to them by a newscaster with a nice suit and a shiny, pearly white smile under, you know, million-dollar studio lights. I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that the public will become aware of these issues, but I think that's really the point of shows like this one and the work that we do is to get people aware that this system is fundamentally flawed and that we have to seek out the alternatives.
You were talking about Japan. They haven't seen a wage increase in the last 2 years under Abenomics, and pointing out this is a problem. Right, they may not have seen wage increases, but what about unemployment? Even though people aren't getting more money, are they losing their jobs or are they holding on to their jobs in Japan?
Employment is fairly stable in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different type of manipulation. In America, they just cook the books. I mean, the numbers that are coming out, the 5% numbers or whatever, are just ridiculous on their face, and the labor participation rate shows that. I think, what is it, 94 million Americans now of working age that don't have a job. But not all of them are unemployed because they're not looking for work or whatever phony cooked up definitions they come up with. In Japan, there really isn't a lot of that chronic unemployment that's being obscured by statistical manipulation, but here there's a lot of make work jobs that only exist to basically give people a job. I mean,
you mean in Japan?
In Japan, sorry, yes, yeah. Here in Japan. So you have people who are, directing traffic at shopping malls, parking lots, and things like this. I mean, completely meaningless make work type of jobs. Construction is notoriously a kind of make work project here that is run generally by either mafia or ex-policemen, and they get these cushy contracts, and then they hire, you know, a dozen workers to stand around a hole, you know, for 12 hours and do not a lot of anything. So, I mean, there isn't a lot of unemployment here, not that kind of chronic unemployment, but there's a lot of meaningless make-work kind of jobs here and a lot of very, very small-paying jobs.
Well, then they have their way of concealing unemployment in Japan. They do that by hiring people to do meaningless jobs. We conceal our unemployment in this country by cooking the books and saying there's only 5 million unemployed, where according to some figures, I've got an article here by Michael Snyder, and the headline, he says, now there are 102.6 million working-age Americans that do not have a job. So which is better? A massive unemployment or no increase in wages? And is either better, or do they both, foreshadow an enormous amount of trouble?
Well, neither one is a happy situation, but I mean, just looking at it from the human perspective, most people on the planet want to put in a hard day's work and get paid for it and put food on their table and feel like they've accomplished something. I mean, I think that's part of the fundamental drive of the human species, and most people can relate to that. Of course, there are exceptions, but a lot of people just want to do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. So from that perspective, to have meaningless jobs, I mean, at least people have some sense that they are doing something. But to be one of those, you know, 100 whatever million it is now, that of people that just aren't really counted and, you know, are just kind of swept under the rug. I mean, what a meaningless existence in so many different ways. And I think that breeds the kind of despair and hopelessness that can be really pervasive and really eat into a society.
All right, let's take a break for some commercials, and James Corbett and I will be back in a moment on Financial Survival. I'm here with James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from the Corbett Report. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit, toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask here with James Corbett on Financial Survival. And we were talking, when we broke for commercials, James was talking about the need for jobs. And you pointed out that people without jobs are prone to despair and hopelessness, that we need jobs not simply to get the money, right? We need to have a sense of self-worth that we can find in, most of us do, that we can find in having a job, a meaningful job. And it suggests, if that's true, it suggests that people on welfare are necessarily being driven towards anger, at least despair and hopelessness, and perhaps to anger. Do you agree with that, or do you think I'm making a mistake?
Oh, no, I really do agree with that. I mean, I think when you look back at revolutionary moments in history, like, for example, the French Revolution, it's not even necessarily the economic side of it that is really the contributing factor, the spark that starts the revolution, so much as it is the sort of demoralization that happens in a public that sees the expanding difference, the gulf between the very people at the top, the people at the very top of the economy versus the people at the bottom. And when that becomes very visible, then you start to get those revolutionary moments. And in fact, I was reading an interesting piece about how the lead up to the French Revolution, it was actually overall for the generation or so preceding the revolution, it was an expanding economy. There was actually increasing standards of living amongst most of the French public. But it was the fact that they were starting to get a taste of, you know, the better life. And then that was pulled out from under the rugs by bad harvests and famine and things of that nature that really sparked the revolution. And I think we can see similar types of revolutionary fervor coming along. I mean, that's being felt in the political sense right now by these, you know, firebrands and rogues who are, you know, coming towards the surface of the political sphere. So you can see why a Sanders or a Trump would be so popular at this moment in time in the United States. I mean, make America strong might be some ridiculous political rhetoric buzzword, but it appeals to people who have been so demoralized by their lack of, you know, meaningful employment and sense of opportunity that obviously it's striking a chord with a lot of people. And I think we can understand this as not just an economic phenomenon, but more fundamentally a psychological and social phenomenon.
Speaking of Bernie Sanders, he's the avowed socialist. He's raised almost as much money in contributions from small private donors as Hillary Clinton has raised from big PACs and the super rich. More, Bernie Sanders is attracting crowds of 20,000 or more to his rallies. Can Bernie Sanders count on the political support of what Michael Snyder guesstimates to be about 103 million unemployed Americans? If Sanders and his notion of socialism and perhaps putting a chicken in every pot, is that going to create, is that going to galvanize 103 million people? And if so, who can beat him in the 2016 election? I mean, Trump has some interesting ideas. Yeah, we'll make America great again. But what's that got to do with the people that are unemployed? I don't think Trump is speaking to the unemployed. And if Michael Snyder is correct, there's 103 million unemployed. That's a third of the population. And this is adults. This is a potential political revolution. So I'm asking, is the combination of Bernie Sanders' socialism and his promises to provide food and money for the unemployed and the 103 million unemployed, is that about to precipitate a revolutionary victory for socialism and a massive political change in America in 2016?
Potentially. I mean, I could see how that could develop into that type of narrative. And I think more easily see that as an actual narrative developing than Trump. I mean, I think Trump is a kind of political flash in the pan. I think he'll be gone by the time we get into the primaries and you know, things start to shake out. But Sanders, one could see that actually continuing. The question of who could actually dethrone him, I mean, I guess really we have to see what Hillary has up her sleeve. And I know it's ridiculous to say, because there's no reason on earth that Hillary should even be in the running, let alone a front runner. But you know, the Clintons have more than 9 lives, I think, politically. They have a million lives and, you know, maybe a similar number of bodies in the closet that help to ensure their place in the hierarchy. So I'm sure there will be lots of dirty tricks and what have you. I'm certainly not a fan of Sanders and socialism as the answer, but I certainly see why it is appealing to so many people right now. And I think there's absolutely a moment for political populism right now. And that mood has been in the air for several years now. And we saw, I think, Obama's campaign, I think, brilliantly kind of take that momentum and, like, in a jujitsu move, kind of use it against itself and, hope and change. And they made that the central part of their campaign. And they sort of diffused that energy. I think that energy is still there. In fact, perhaps more so now that people have been squandering in this economic doldrum for several years now. I think people are really looking for something that they perceive to be fundamentally different, and I think Sanders is offering that. So there's definitely a case to be made that he'll be.
And there's 103 million of them.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
If Michael Snyder is correct, there's 103 million. That's a wave of potential voters that nobody can match. Republicans have nothing to bring in 103 million people.
Yes,
I mean, this
I
is
agree.
Weak.
Yeah.
When I saw Bernie Sanders first enter the race, I thought, this, you know, isn't that sweet? he got this white-haired old guy who's going to take a shot at being president. I thought, yeah, that's cute, you know. No, this is serious and potentially revolutionary and feeding off the unemployment. I've got an article here, another one from Michael Snyder. World War III, this is the headline, World War III, Russia putting on display a firepower that is shocking the world. The Russians have unleashed their own version of shock and awe in Syria, and the brutal efficiency of their airstrikes against ISIS targets has stunned many observers around the world. For more than a year, the Obama administration has claimed that its bombing campaign in Syria has been a success, and yet ISIS has continued to grow. And yes, just in a matter of days, Russians have done great harm to ISIS, and we are left to wonder, why did those ISIS targets still exist in the first place? This is Michael Snyder. Was the U.S. military unable to identify them previously, or could it be possible that the Obama administration did not want to hit the ISIS targets? What do you think about that? Are we really fighting against ISIS? Are we funding ISIS? What are we doing?
No, of course, I don't think the fight has really been against ISIS. I mean, obviously, they're putting in the show, but I don't think they've done anything to fundamentally remove ISIS. And Russia is, I think, brilliantly calling out that hypocrisy. I think they're showing it for the farce that it is. And at the latest, actually, today, they've just started a naval bombardment. So they've been launching cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea and over Iran, over Iraq, over Iran, into Syria. So 1,000 miles away, they've been striking with cruise missiles today. So, again, just unleashing more spectacular firepower and showing what an actual resistance to the Islamic State would actually look like if the U.S. or any of the other allies against ISIS were serious.
Yeah.
So this is obviously showing it for what it is, which is a farce. And I think the only question is how can the U.S., the Saudis, the Turks, all of these people in this alliance, how can they respond to it? Because, I mean, ultimately, I think they've already lost the game diplomatically because they've, of course, been giving lip service to this great growing ISIS threat for so many years. And now that it's actually being taken care of, oh, no, you can't do that. I think they've been backed into a corner.
I know. It's they're caught in a situation where they either have to now follow Russia's lead to exterminate them, but following Russia's lead all by itself is damaging to the Obama administration, or they can resist it or just ignore it, and it just makes them look stupid, impotent, and weak. I mean, they're caught in this, they have been humiliated. And some might suppose that Russia would be content with as much humiliation as they've imposed on the American military and the Obama administration by going after ISIS. But this next article I've got shows that Russia may be just getting started. This one's from Reuters, and it says Russian warplanes in Syria destroy U.S.-trained rebels' weapons depots. All right, Beirut, Russian airstrikes have destroyed the main weapon depot of the U.S.-trained rebel group in Syria. In an expansion of Russian attacks on insurgents backed by foreign enemies of President Bashar Assad. It appears that Russia's got your back. Russia's got your back. They don't care who's going after Assad, whether it's indigenous rebels or ISIS or people that are backed by the United States. Russia is there to protect Assad. That by itself is impressive. They have initially, in the last week or so, started attacking ISIS forces that threatened President Assad. Now Russia is attacking U.S.-supported rebels that were attacking President Assad. Is Russia goading the U.S. tiger, or is it goading a paper tiger, a fiat tiger, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, Russia's interest is to defend their own military personnel at Latakia and Tarsus on the Mediterranean Sea coast. So I think that their initial airstrikes, as was pointed out by the U.S. at the time, were centered more on that area on the western side of Syria that that isn't actually under the control of the Islamic State. It's more of these rebel opposition groups that are being funded and supported by the U.S. and what have you. So I think from the outset of this most recent campaign, a week or so ago, I think we've seen that these strikes are being directed at really anything that's threatening the Russian interests primarily, and of course as an adjunct of that to anything that's threatening Assad's forces. And I don't think Russia is making any bones about that they are there to help support Assad in their fight against the terrorist insurgency. So I think that this is brilliantly summed up in a cartoon. It's an editorial cartoon. I don't know who actually did the cartoon, but the Russian embassy in United Arab Emirates tweeted it out of their Twitter account. And it's a cartoon of, arm and equip and fund the right terrorist. And they have all of the different brigades, not only ISIS and the al-Nusra Front, but all of the various different factions that are there in Syria. And they all look, of course, exactly identical. And you're supposed to cut out this, model, this little bazooka and place it in the hands of the right terrorist. And I think it makes the point quite brilliantly that there has never been some moderate opposition and never will be in the whole Syrian debacle. It has been a terrorist insurgency from the beginning, and every single time the alliance has funded any sort of so-called moderate group, their weapons, their funds, and their personnel end up fighting for or fighting with al-Nusra, or fighting with literal al-Qaeda in Iraq, or fighting with the Islamic State or these other boogeymen. So, I mean, I don't think you can claim that this is some sort of oops, oh, wouldn't you know it, all of our weapons and supplies ended up in their hands once again. I think by this point, I mean, it's obviously something that's well known. It's a strategy, and let's not forget that the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency said he felt the White House was purposefully building up the Islamic State.
Is the United States so tied down by a multitude of treaties, and perhaps by a multitude of secret schemes, that it can no longer move without alienating one or more of its treaty partners? In other words, is Russia basically free because it hasn't signed treaties with everybody? They go in and just hammer them, bomb them, kill them all, that's all. Well, the United States has to pussyfoot around because we're working deals with everybody, and as a result, we can't actually act. Do you follow what I'm saying? Is there values?
I do. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think it's kind of more to do with the fact that the U.S. is on the side of all of these people in the region who have been involved in funding the opposition in Syria for many years. Saudi Arabia, obviously, Turkey, the Gulf states, Qatar, and places like that. All of that opposition has various pieces of, stakes in the country. Russia has actually formed alliances now, but it's with Syria, it's with Iraq, it's with Iran, and China is also part of this, interestingly enough. So the actual countries that are actually being affected, that are actually now asking the Russians to come in, where of course the Syrian government hasn't asked the United States or anyone else to, please bomb us. So I think there's a quantitative, qualitative difference in the alliances that have been forged on these sides. And I think one is genuinely interested in self-defense of their nation, and then the other side is kind of, what can we get out of this? And because that's their role in this is to come in as this outside force, of course they want to, make sure they cut up the pie in the right way and, oh, you can't bomb these people, we're funding them, and things like that. That's why I think there's been so much pussyfooting around on the U.S. side.
Is there any way for the Obama administration to emerge from the current Middle East debacle without being dishonored and just shown to be stupid, weak, impotent, whatever? Is there a silver lining in this for Obama?
Oh, I really don't see a way out of this at this point. Again, I think the Russians have called them on their bluff brilliantly. I guess, Fox News and whatever can, just wave the flag. And I guess people who still believe those types of propaganda outlets might still, believe whatever they say. But I think they've been pretty much exposed for what they are and what their role in the region is. And the conspiratorial side of me wants to say that this is really part of the bigger agenda of what's going on here. The U.S. has to be the rogue state that is being put in line by the Russians and what have you in order to bring about the new, the new order of whatever the U.N. or its replacements in the future or whatever is going to look like. In order to have a global order, you have to have this reason to put this, reckless rogue empire in its place. And I think that's part of the narrative that's being developed here. And a lot of people, even in the alternative media, are promoting that as if, you know, Russia are now the paragons of virtue in the world and, you know, we can all get behind them. I think that's a dangerous way of looking at it because ultimately I think it plays into the globalist agenda.
Well, we're going to have to let it go with that because we are out of time. James, I want to thank you as always for being on the program. Always a pleasure talking to you. I enjoy the conversations. I enjoy your answers, and I enjoy trying to come up with questions. Look forward to trying again next Thursday. In the meantime, folks, thanks for listening, and may the good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank the producer. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.